John Gambling with special co-host Mayor Michael Bloomberg on News Talk Radio 710 WOR. Now, here are John Gambling and Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
It's 8 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. Yes, Friday. Mayor Michael Bloomberg is along, and we've got the school's chancellor, Dennis Wolcott, as well. Mr. Mayor, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Dennis, good morning
to
you.
And good morning to you.
It's a pleasure. I just point out for people that don't have cameras here, you and I are casual. Our school's chancellor, in a suit, ready to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Always ready to go.
Always.
Your marching orders.
An image.
It's your marching orders.
That's exactly right.
Be ready to go first thing in the morning.
I don't know how you do it all. Every time I turn on the television or something, I see the chancellor, you know, running around some school hall someplace.
Well, there's 1,700 schools. I castigated him because he didn't go to all 1,700 graduations this year.
And you did do that, too.
I did.
No, it's a busy time. I mean, even with the summer, it's an active period of time, and we're going around to the different schools. Wednesday night, had a meeting with parents and community members. We introduced our new executive director of our parent family engagement office, Jesse Mojica, who is really a great guy. I mean, a fantastic guy. We had roughly 200 to 300 parents out and superintendents. And talking about community engagement, as the mayor knows, last week we had a lawsuit decided in our favor, so now we're starting work on our co-locations and also the process of phasing out the schools that we wanted to phase out.
How long does that take? How long a process is that?
Well, it has to take rather, it's going to be rather fast because school opens for...
It's
starting now.
Immediately.
Yeah. So with the number of the charter schools will start second week in August. So their staff report next week, so we have to do a lot of work over the last couple of weeks, or last week into this week and next week. And so we have a lot going on. And then we're ending summer school this coming week. We had roughly 34,000 students in summer school. So it's a busy period of time.
And the tenure numbers, I think, from my point of view, we're working in the right direction.
The state law has tenure, whether you like it or not. We have to work with that. You can make the case that it may have been necessary in the McCarthy era, maybe even today at the university level, but that in public education, you're not writing papers about, you know, things that are very controversial, which was the idea of tenure to protect your ability to do that and not lose your job. Do you remember, are you now or have you ever been, or are you too young for that?
Most of the audience
would not have any idea what
McCarthyism,
I'm
yeah, I certainly
sure,
do.
Absolutely. I remember seeing it on television. I remember my father explaining to me what was going on as this guy ruined people's lives and was a terrible
time. It was a strange time.
Oh, God. Anyways, tenure is on the books. You're supposed to evaluate teachers and decide whether they have the right to be a job forever. And people say, well, it's not forever, but it's very, very difficult, virtually impossible, and statistically impossible to fire a teacher once they get tenure. So you want to be absolutely very careful in terms of who you give tenure to. If some are not ready, and you say, okay, you got another year, get back to work, here, we'll help you, we'll train, and hopefully you'll get to it because we've already made a big investment in you. We don't want you to fail, but it's so difficult for the students, who are the big losers, if somebody gets tenure and shouldn't have, that we want to take as much precautions so we can. In the past, 97% of the teachers got tenure, so it was virtually automatic.
I think years ago it was 94%.
Whatever.
It went down. Started at 97 around 2007.
That's overstating it. But, you know, it was just, it was hard to argue that there was any real process. This time, Dennis put in some much more rigorous use of statistics in terms of what the kids do on tests, evaluations by the principal, which is the way everybody in the private sector gets evaluated. None of us, or virtually none of us, have maybe salesmen or some people like that in those professions. But generally, it's totally subjective. Your boss thinks you're ready for the next move or doesn't, and you either keep your job or you don't. Get paid more or you get paid less or whatever. So anyways, we put in the statistic, the more rigorous tests. 58% did get tenure of those who were the roughly 5,000 that were up for it after 3 years of teaching. 58% yes. The balance, some quit, some we said absolutely not. But most of them we said, look, you're not bad teachers. You're just not up to the standards that we want, and we will work with you to make you more effective, hopefully, and hopefully next year you'll pass. And would be great for us if that's the case.
I thought the number that was absolutely denied, the 3%, was pretty small.
Well, yeah, it's pretty small, but at the same time, it compares to basically last year. But as the mayor indicated, I think the 39% number is really the real number, because you have people who are being extended a year, and you're going to be taking a look at them and really applying a number of professional development strategies to make them up to the level we want them to be in front of our classroom. So you'll see the number probably go up again next year as far as those denied. But the reality is, and the mayor has talked about this from the beginning, really applying a rigorous system to making sure that when teachers come up for tenure, they're able to be granted tenure based on performance, not by default. And that 58% number is an amazing number, and it's as a result of the mayor. And one of the things we got to be very clear about is that they basically are in for life. Once they get tenure, they are there. And there's a process called 30-20-A if you're going to go after a teacher because of poor performance. It's a very rigorous process, and we have to do a better job in making sure we hold to that standard. But even with that standard, it is difficult to remove a teacher once they receive tenure.
Dennis, is there, after one receives tenure, is there a process of a continuing evaluation, not to deny them tenure, but to make sure that they're still...
Well, they already have tenure. The whole idea is, correct, from then on, fundamentally, you can't do anything.
No, I understand.
But you have to really show incompetence, right, which is very difficult an independent arbitrator.
But I'm curious whether or not they're within the system. You can
evaluate.
Check to see if they are keeping themselves current.
Yes, you can evaluate. But even with the evaluation, as the mayor indicated, it is difficult to remove them. And so it's a very difficult process. And principals would love to be able to have the power just to remove a teacher based on poor performance. But once that teacher has tenure, it becomes extremely difficult. So
this is so much different than other city agencies or the private world. The union argues all the time, well, it could be arbitrary. Yes, it could be. But, you know, the real world we live in is you get evaluated by your boss, and hopefully your boss is intelligent and not predisposed against anybody and really looks at the facts. And sometimes they'll be right, sometimes they're wrong, but that's the real world. This is the one part of city government, really, where it is just not possible. And when you try to remove somebody who you think is not doing a good enough job and should not be in front of the classroom, the procedure, you go before an independent
arbitrator.
Mm-hmm. An independent arbitrator that works is appointed both by the city and the union, is somebody that will virtually always say no, you
and
can't
it can
get
stretch
rid.
Over years.
Yeah,
over a period of time,
tens of thousands.
Well, how can that be
years?
An independent arbiter if it always goes the
Well, because if they don't side with the argument is, I don't know if it's true or not, but people say if they don't side with one side, they'll never get appointed again. But that's a bit. Whereas up until they get tenure, it's fundamentally there's some recourse, but it's fundamentally the discretion of the Department of Ed, who makes the discretion and has the discretion to hire. And, you know, if you say, well, wait a second, if the Department of Ed is the one that can hire people, why shouldn't they also be the one that can decide, look, I made a mistake or I tried, but it didn't work. Let's get on to the next thing.
I saw an interview on television with a gentleman who was denied tenure. And he said, you know, probably I shouldn't have gotten tenure. And he talked about what he did, what he didn't do. And interesting thing, Mr. Mayor, is that, you know, they're developing portfolios now. So they're presenting portfolios to their principals. So there's a greater pride already being taken by
portfolio is a list of what they've accomplished and that sort of thing.
And so there's a greater pride taking place with the teachers now and making sure that they're truly prepared for tenure review. And it's not going to be just by default. And that's something that I think is significant.
The 39% that were said, you know, we'll review you again next year, did most of those, or the ones that you've had contact or reports back from, do they understand? Are they looking at this positively, that, you know, this is an opportunity for them?
Well, I'm sure they're disappointed they didn't get it.
Correct. But what I'm saying is, are they
depends
down in
the
dumps
individual.
Over it, or are they going to say, hey,
individual.
I'm going to grab
and
it?
And those that don't look at it positively leave. Say, maybe this is not a career for me, or I don't want to work here, or I don't like so-and-so, or, you know.
And
whatever.
They have an understanding of why. And so that's the reality. And then there are those who say, you know, I need further development. I'm not going to be the greatest teacher or really deserve tenure after a three-year period of time. So let me give it a
in the private
year.
Sector, I've always said in my company, if you ever have to make the decision of looking somebody in the eye and saying, I'm sorry, but you're not going to continue working here, we're letting you go, if that person is surprised, then you're not a good manager. you should have been letting them know that their performance was not up to snuff. You should have been working with them to try to make them better, because the company has every organization has a big investment in them. Sure. So it should never be a surprise. And my experience in, I've been around a long time and have had to make a lot of tough decisions or been told by others, hey, you go and do this. And I don't think any time, maybe once, and I can't remember who the person was, maybe it was zero, that they were surprised. They just, in a lot of cases, relieved. Knew that they weren't doing a good job, struggled, couldn't make the personal decision to pull the plug themselves. Now at least they can get on with their lives.
And that's the role of the principal observation. I mean, the principal goes into the classroom, meets with the teacher, observes what's going on, gives them the feedback, and talks about what they need to do. And some of it can revolve around classroom management. Some of it deals with gains of the performance of the students and their variety of factors. So the principal should be providing that feedback to the teacher, and that allows the teacher to gain as far as experience is concerned.
All right. The boss is saying it's time for you to go back to work.
That's why I have my shirt, tie, and suit on so I can go back to work. Mr. Mayor?
Dennis?
I know you're about to say something. Graduation. Look at you. You're about to say something. You edited yourself.
Mr. Chancellor, Dennis, good to see
you. John.
As
Mr.
always.
Mayor, pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Mr. Mayor, sit tight. Let me take a break right here, 19 minutes after 8 o'clock, and remind everybody, we'll take your calls and your questions, 800-321-0710. 800-321-0710. We'll do that coming up. Get in line now. It is Simon & Garfunkel Bumper Music Friday on the John Gambling Show.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones. Looking for fun and feeling good.
I picked Simon & Garfunkel for you today because I know that he's your neighbor.
Art Garfunkel lives two doors away, and most mornings I see him sitting, having coffee at a local diner outside, reading his book. He does it winter, spring, summer,
sits
fall.
Sits outside reading his book.
He is oblivious to the weather. He loves New York. Okay, inside, both Art and Paul Simon. Every time in the last 10 years I've asked either one to do something for the city, they are two great New Yorkers. I happen to think they're great performers, and I love their music, and I love it particularly together. The two of them, but in terms of great citizens, they deserve an A+, both of them.
All right, couldn't agree with you more. That's why they have been chosen for today, our bumper music performers. Let's see here, your reaction to the doctor, head of OSHA, who ruled that cancer is not part of the Zadroga bill.
Well, he didn't quite say that. The city's always stood up for our first responders and fought to ensure that the federal government owns up to its responsibility to help those who went down there to engage in what started out to be a rescue effort and quickly, unfortunately, became a recovery effort. And that's exactly what the Zadroga bill does. It requires, it requires the federal government to review health studies to determine if there was a link between 9/11 work and cancer. And a lot of people are distressed because the doctor, Dr. John Howard of the National Institute for Occupational Health and Safety, who really has a phenomenally great reputation, he said, he didn't say it doesn't cause. He said that there was insufficient medical evidence, is a technical term he used, so far to link post 9/11 work with cancer. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that the studies scientifically leave some don't prove conclusively, or I think would be probably a good way to phrase it. Now there's a number of other studies going on. The city's doing one, and we sort of think that eventually the evidence will be there to show the direct link, and that the monies will flow. But the doctor did what the law requires and good science requires, and I think even he would say this is nothing to take away from the sacrifice that was made or the damage to people's lives, health. But you have to live with the law and whatever the science says. You can't have your own facts.
No, of course. Some have suggested, though, that if there's an error to be made, to error on the side of those that were there.
I think any reputable doctor or scientist would say that's politics. There is a standard. of proof, and when you don't meet that standard, maybe you do another test. You look for more information. That's not to say you don't walk away from it, but you don't make up facts, and that's unfortunately when you're pandering to the crowd is so easy to do, and hopefully responsible elected officials don't do that. What we're focusing on is doing other studies. We're trying to get more evidence to show that what we think is it, that is the case, rather than just sitting there yelling. You're yelling at everybody and blaming people, didn't do anything for the people who really put their lives on the line and unfortunately are paying for it.
Have you read the story about a group of people, including an atheist group, that want the Iron Cross that was lowered into the memorial the other day, removed? Well, I mean, talk about crazies.
Well,
my words.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be careful, I think, in criticizing people. Number one, they have a right to sue, and we'll see what the judge says. Number two, I think it probably it is. There are other religious artifacts that will be displayed. A lot of people look to religion for strength after the attack. There are a lot of things going into this museum. There's a fire truck, which I was there when they lowered it all packaged up and down into.
Very interesting picture watching.
Yeah,
that
there's other religious items. There's a Star of David that was cut from World Trade Center steel, and a Bible fused to PFAS steel found during the recovery effort, and a Jewish prayer shawl. Now, I think what this group would argue is none of those things are appropriate. I think that my personal opinion has always been you shouldn't tell people what religion to practice or whether to practice a religion, but you also shouldn't prevent people from practicing whatever religion they want in any ways they want. And so there's nothing wrong with having plenty of things in the museum that have no religious significance, like the fire truck. But on the other hand, clearly people... This influenced people. It gave them strength.
They take solace from that, no matter what their religion.
And I don't think we should take away their, you know, in a museum, you want to show things that impacted people's behavior back then, even if you don't think it was right. It's history. The museums are for history and to teach people by example of this is what people did back then, and you're free to make your own decision. And this group of atheists, they're free in our country to not believe and not practice, and we should defend their right to do that just as much as we should defend every individual's right to practice and to believe.
Has the program for Sunday 9/11, has that been put together? Has that been finalized? Do you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have. We're going to have... I hope I'm not letting the cigarette out of the bag, but two presidents, George W. Bush, who was president at the time, and Barack Obama, current president. We're going to have three governors, Governor Christie, Governor Cuomo, two present governors, and Governor Pataki, who was the governor at the time. Two mayors, Rudy Giuliani, who was the mayor at the time, and yours truly. And that's it. There are, you have no idea.
Oh, really? That's it?
Well, each time we, and they're going to read something which we pre-select.
Each individual.
Each individual at a time. We're going to stop when planes hit, when buildings came down. We're going to read all the names for the first time, including those people who died in Washington and in Pennsylvania, whereas in the past we'd only read the names of those at the World Trade Center. But, you know, two things. One, you want to, this cannot be political. So that's why there's a poem or a quote or something that each of the readers will read so that nobody can ever accuse.
There's no speech being
no
made.
No speeches whatsoever. Just the families. And this isn't just not an appropriate thing. And there's an awful lot of people who would like to participate. And you just can't do that. And once you open it up, so the argument here is elected officials and those who were there at the time. And how to say, had some influence. And this is the group. And, you know, it'll be as solemn, if not more so, than in the... we've had 10 of them already because we have had a six-month ceremony as well as one every year. It's going to be on the west side of the memorial, actually in the highway. And then family members and family members only will be allowed to walk onto the plaza, look at their loved ones' names, look down into the voids. The public, no. Public starts day two. But the first day, it's reserved for those family members who lost somebody on 9/11. And, you know, it's a difficult site to work with. And for the next few years, you're going to have to go through a lot of security and go a very roundabout way to get there because there's a construction site on three sides of it. You've got to keep people safe.
Will you be able to get to the waterfalls?
Oh, yes.
I mean, you will be able to get on
the waterfalls site. Are working, and all the names there, you'll be able to walk up and touch the names and look over around all both of the voids. The voids are exactly the size and location of the old Twin Towers. One of them, the North Tower, is very close to the Freedom North Memorial, is very close to the, or void is very close to the new Freedom Tower. So we'll have up scaffolding to protect people after this, when, if anything, God forbid, were to fall. But is built around enough. And then there's one corner of the memorial where you won't be able to walk because the Port Authority path terminal is being built in that direction.
That's that tilted building?
Right, and it goes underneath the Memorial Plaza, and that's not done yet. But the rest, you know, a lot of the trees will be there, most of them. Most of the plaza will be open. You'll have to just come in from the west side, and incidentally, we have a ticketing system because we just don't want lots of people to show up and not to be able to get on. And for security reasons, given there's limited access and limited egress in an emergency, you have to be able to get people out. So there's a limit to how many people we can have on the plaza at any one time. And it's a very carefully, well-thought-out system. I'm sure some people are going to complain. We've had a couple hundred thousand reservations already. A couple of days already are fully booked. But, you know,
they're expecting millions, I think, right? The first year?
The High Line had 1 million or 2 million, something like that, in the first year. So, sure, I mean, 1 million people sounds like a lot. But, you know, given New York, given the impact on the world and on freedom that took place here, you would expect a very large number of people. And we just don't know how long they're going to stay. We've made estimates. We've talked to consultants around the world of what people do when they go to the Vietnam Memorial or a Holocaust Museum. There's a museum is it Oklahoma City where the building came down?
The Morrill Building.
You know, and you look and see, well, maybe it'll be the same. But it gives you some feel for it. And so you just go on, nyc.gov is as good a ways to get it. They'll tell you how to get there.
All right, interesting. Thanks for the preview. Let us preview a little bit more news for you.
And she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout. He started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. Oh, what did mama saw? It was against the law.
Simon and Garfunkel, Bumper like Music that. Friday. I knew you said
I,
you liked
I was
that
waiting to see when you were going to hit the button. I was hoping you'd go on.
Oh, we could do that. I can turn your mic up. See how that works? I don't think people tuned in to listen to the music necessarily. So.
No, but they pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? So instead of the mayor, you mean, push the button.
Yep.
Not many people can turn the mayor off.
you have that power.
Let's see here. Willits Point Development. What's going on out there?
We are progressing ahead. The city owns most of the land, a little bit more that we have to get, I think still have to get by eminent domain, but every court battle, people keep suing and we keep winning. You know, if you look at it, there's a handful of small businesses there, and I'm sympathetic to them. They've got to find a place to do business, but it's an enormous piece of land right in the heart of the city. We cannot afford to have most of it just be one-story, small, you know, a handful of small businesses. There's got to be a better use of that land, and people say, oh, well, you know, you should... They have a right to it. Well, you know, by that argument, you'd never do anything. Central Park would never have been built. Nothing, no road would ever get built. Society has to say, sympathetic, and we'll try to help, but nevertheless, there's an overriding public purpose. And we will, I think before we leave office, all of the infrastructure in or almost in, and the land cleared, and then as the economy dictates, people or permits, people will build, and there's lots of plans for housing and stores and employing a lot of people. And you look at other places where we've done it in the city with enormous angst and lawsuits and everything, most of them have turned out pretty well. We had a chance in the Bronx, and some of the local politicians for decades will have damaged the Bronx because we couldn't get something done. That was the Bronx Armory, Kingsbridge Armory. But in the Bronx, there's a big center on the east, on the Harlem River. That's phenomenal. You look at the number of people that come there. These places employ a lot of people, and they give the citizens the ability to shop. And that's one of the things here. If you don't let the stores and businesses grow here, they will do it elsewhere. It's interesting. I saw in the paper today there's a brand new Learjet. I know the president doesn't like small. It flies around in a 747.
I saw the same story. It was in the Wall Street Journal.
Mexico, the latest Learjet is 85% being built in Mexico. They're probably all those engineers would have come to work here. The businesses would have been here and all the ancillary jobs, except we don't let people into the country. So Mexico is building this thriving aerospace industry. And people say, oh, you know, the Mexicans, they're coming across the border to take our jobs. Wrong. The Mexican economy is doing better in many senses than the American economy. And that's one of the reasons it's been relatively easy to stop the flow of people across the Texas and Arizona-Mexican border. It's because they're not coming. As a matter of fact, people are going back to Mexico because that's where the job creation is. So, you know, we've got to do these things, whether it's at the city level here or there. Some people said, well, one of these applied science schools, which were campuses which we're trying to get to come to New York City, should go to Willets Point. You know, people who are making the proposals, we've asked for proposals, we're waiting for them, we've got an independent commission to select. Some of them, everybody so far, it's on the list of places you could go. Nobody has wanted to do that. There are Governor's Island, Roosevelt Island, the Brooklyn Navy Yard seem to be the three places that are most attractive. And, you know, these universities don't have to come here. So you can't say you do that or else. Their else's? Okay.
There's lots of else's.
Yeah.
Speaking of businesses and the city, what's going on? What have you been told by your folks about Jerome Avenue in the wake of that huge water main break up there earlier this week?
36-inch pipe. That's a big pipe.
That's moving a lot of water.
Every time I do that math, it's 3 feet. I'm not that much taller than that. I'm double that. You might just look a little bit shorter
is
than
that what
6 feet.
It is?
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. I'm wearing flats.
I got you.
The pipe was, I don't know, we think installed in the year 1903. But there's a lot of pipes that work. And when they break, you fix them. And, you know, it'll get back. And
does the city take care of businesses
and
residences?
Yeah, there's all sorts of plan. I did see that John Liu, city controller, had some of his people out there to help people fill out forms, which is a good thing. I'm glad he did that. And, you know, we've got a number of things to do. And, you know, your heart goes out to those stores and businesses, but you try to get them back up. And there's no ways to prevent something like this. Can't go and dig up all the water mains in the city. Forget about it. That's just not...
Stuff happens, unfortunately.
Yeah, stuff does happen, unfortunately. You know, the Second Avenue subway, it's hurt a lot of businesses for a long, long period of time. And I know Jay Walden's tried to help, and the city has programs to try to help those businesses. But either you want the subway or you don't. And in this case, you know, it's an accident. So...
The MTA said that they want some city money for capital projects. You got
MTA needs money from
$250 million they wanted.
Let me check. I'll call our finance director and see if taxes came in yesterday. The MTA has been starved by the state for a long time. The state even takes MTA money for other things these days. It just can't happen. What we should do is we should find some ways to raise money for the MTA, something that would encourage more people to take mass transit so there'd be more fare payers and you'd better use the equipment, and something where the revenues would be dedicated from however you incentivize people to go take mass transit. The revenues would go to making the capital investment so that every 2 years rates don't have to go up. You know, they're going to go up every 2 years. What we should do is maybe toll the bridges. What a brilliant idea.
God, where did I hear that? It sounds like an echo bouncing off the mountain.
You know, I still think that there's a chance that it'll come back.
Oh, I think it will. I think it will too.
I mean, we're going to have to do something. And
I see one of the things they're arguing about in Albany over the outer borough cab legislation is a 50-cent contribution to the MTA for every drop of the flag.
Yes, that is on there. We've got to find a ways to get money for the MTA, period. And everybody says, not this, not this, not this. Okay, then what? You can't pay your workers with not this. You can't invest in safety things and reliability things and new services and a bigger catchment area unless you have more money. And the legislature talks about it. They then put in this tax on some of the counties around New York City, which is very controversial. And they say, well, let's get rid of that and, you know, tax toll the bridges. The money's just... It doesn't add up. You've got to do some of the things that, no matter how unpalatable, this is what they, if they had put in congestion pricing back then, we wouldn't have that today. But they didn't. And so let's learn to live with this.
I spoke earlier this morning with Patrick Donahue, who is the United States Postmaster General, and we talked about a lot of things, but you saw the list of the closings of post offices throughout the tri-state area.
People aren't using the mails because of email and FedEx and UPS, and we have to adjust. And when, you know, the post office, I think, employs something like 400,000 people?
Five and a quarter at the moment. I only know this because I was talking with them, but they expect to go to 4.25 in a few years.
I'm sorry for the people losing their jobs, but the bottom line is if nobody uses the Postal Service or uses it less, they can't afford like anything else. And we're going to have some very painful decisions here at all levels of government. New York City next year is going to have a $5 billion deficit, and all we've got is $2 billion left to help plug it.
Will the city get whacked with this deficit nonsense that's going on in Washington?
Everybody's going to get whacked. Number one, the damage that's being done by the stuff in Washington is continuous, and even if tonight they voted to fix this problem, people are going to say, wait a second, look at all of that chaos. They couldn't work together. They actually considered not paying our bills. I'm not going to trust America, the U.S. dollar, American bonds, the way I did before. In the back of everybody's mind is going to be some doubt. And so countries aren't going to use the dollar as a reserve currency as much. They'll still do it. They don't have any choice. There's no other market big enough, but less. They'll diversify more. People are going to think twice before buying U.S. bonds. They'll still buy them because they just need something. If you're going to invest money, there just aren't alternatives of the right magnitude, but a little less. They'll diversify. Companies, banks are going to make loans, but a little bit less. People are going to hire a little bit less. Looking at the chaos in Washington, both sides of the aisle, both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, regardless of who you particularly think to blame is at fault, the bottom line, everybody agrees, system's not working. And they've just got to figure out a ways to work together and to be rational and have... democracy is about compromise. And when you get groups that say there is no compromise whatsoever, that just doesn't fit with a democracy. A democracy, everybody should get something, but nobody get 100% of what they want. And very few people get nothing. And that's the or everything, and that's what they want, and that's.
But you know, the extreme obstinance that we are seeing here is a result of the frustration, as you point out, of the system not working.
I think that is true. That the Tea Party, which if you look at it, they don't seem to be ideological in the context of flag burning or gay rights or choice, those litmus test issues. They, it looks to me, are a group of people who say the system's not working and they're striking out and they don't quite know where to go or what to do, but it's not working, and they say we're not going to sit here and do nothing, which is dangerous because you can make the situation worse, which I think a lot of the stuff would make the situation dramatically worse. And but I'm sympathetic with people on both sides of the aisle and both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue who say we are not doing as good a job as we should do a lot better. Yes, there's some waste. But most things, not waste or corruption, most money is spent on programs which we want or which we are unwilling to cancel. You could take government and say, let's cut out a lot of stuff. But nobody's willing to do the cuts because somebody is either employed in providing the service or receiving the service. And I think John Sununu, the former senator from New Hampshire, is a good guy. His father was also was governor, I think, before then. I didn't really know the father, but the son is, I do know, and a really smart, nice guy, reasonably conservative, incidentally. But he wrote an article, I think it was in Time Magazine or Newsweek, one of the two, that said 50% of the people in this country get a check from the federal government, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, VA stuff, benefits, and something like 70% benefit from either those checks or tax breaks, like the mortgage deduction on your home mortgage, or the interest deduction on your home mortgage. And you just can't keep doing this. Now, how you fix it, I don't know, but we are bankrupting ourselves. The health care bill, after all of the aggravation, did not do anything to really start, I don't think, to really get a handle on why Europe spends $3,300 per person on health care, we spend $7,500 per person on health care, and they have a life expectancy 2 years greater than ours. There's just something wrong. And, you know, every single program got something because of the way the legislation was done. I thought it should have been written by the White House, sent over to Congress, and then you negotiate. And,
but the White, that's not the way this White House works.
I don't think you just blame the president for it. I think everybody's got some responsibility, and everybody deserves some credit, because keep in mind, our government is still going on, and incidentally, on Monday, world is not going to come to an end if they don't pass anything. We'll find a ways to pay most bills for a while. There's revenue coming in. But to keep this charade going, and then there are people who want to have a six-month fix so that next year, in the middle of an election year, you have all the same chaos again. That's just irrational. For better or worse, fix the thing and fix it now. Because it's going to be much harder to fix then, and all it's going to do is cause chaos. And I think those people, it's going to be interesting to see who the public blames for shutting down government, whatever that means.
All right, Mr. Mayor.
They're not going to be any winners here.
All right, we've got some folks on the line here. We'll get to them in just a second. I see that Mike must be extremely difficult today. We still have one line open, 800-321-0710, if you want to get in that line, 8 before 9 o'clock to the phones coming up. Cold Paul Simon, Art Garfunkel, Bumper Music Friday. I've never seen the mayor tap his toes before.
I love the music. It's my generation.
All right, Mr.
Did I tell you I went to the Paul McCartney concert?
Yes, you did, and loved it.
And he did every one of the songs. I couldn't believe it. It's the second time I've seen him do that.
All right, let's go to the phones. Teresa, you're going to be up first. You got the mayor. Go ahead. Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. I'd like to bring to your attention that in Brooklyn, an increasing number of seniors are being driven into bankruptcy because they have applied for Medicaid, they can't get Medicaid. They see money being spent in Manhattan to build new parks and to build bike lanes to attract yuppies into the city, and yet accessoride is being cut back mercilessly. Essential services being cut
back. Well, Teresa, they're different pots of money. One time, Medicaid, remember, is federal monies that the state and city match, and we're probably building more parks in Brooklyn, or at least as many as we are in Manhattan, and same thing with bicycle lanes. You have to do all of these things, and we have our Department for the Aging. If you call 311, it's run by Lillian Pella Barry, who's a phenomenal, smart woman, and we think we can help the seniors if they get into trouble. So that's what I would do is call 311 if somebody's got a problem. But you have to do all things at the same time, and you have to help everybody.
Okay, we're going to go to Matt on line one. Matt, you've got the mayor. Go.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning.
Good to speak with you.
And you.
Good. I represent a small group of people that have been bidding in New York City for many, many years. And we used to get a set-aside for being a New York City business. And the Buy America clause has also been taken out. It would really help small businesses in New York City. We do uniforms is what we mainly do. And the joke in our business is that if we had to go to war with China, we'd have to go naked because they make all the uniforms over there.
You know, Matt, what's happening to them? If you talk to the Chinese, they're worried because their businesses are starting to leave China and going to other places, Indonesia and Bangladesh and that sort of thing.
Laos.
They have the same problems that we do. It just moves from one to another. Buy America clause, Matt, it's a nice thing, but remember, an awful lot of American business exports stuff overseas, and it's a very dangerous thing when you start saying we're not going to buy from overseas. Also, the American public wants to get the best price and the best product they can. What I think we have to do is make sure that the best products at the best prices are made here in America, and then in a fair competition, we will win, and we'll also be able to sell our stuff overseas. But it is frustrating when you lose business and you say, wait a second, I'm losing business to, and then it's the guy down the street or the guy in the next city, state, or country. And, open fair trade it's difficult to live with, but it's better than the alternatives.
Okay, thanks for the telephone call. And on line five, we've got Mario. Mario, good morning.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call, Mr. Mayor.
I just want
to inform you of a couple of things real quick. I'm in the corrugated box business, and in the last 7 months, we've lost 4 customers to Pennsylvania because of the MTA tax and the oppressive tolls on the MTA bridges. Michael, 3 people are leaving my business today. They work in Queens. They commute to Jersey. I was paying their tolls. It was costing me $60 a day. I can no longer afford it. You have to get the MTA in line and give some sort of a discount to people who live in Queens or live in Long Island and commute to Jersey through no fault of their own. They are impeding my ability to hire the best people because at $20 a day, Michael, they can no longer afford to come to work.
Well, Mario, number one, the city has suggested some things to raise money for the MTA to subsidize the system so that the fares and toll bridges as well aren't as high as they are and unfortunately are going to get worse. So far, the state has been unwilling to go along, or they've done some things like the payroll tax that you talked about. We have to find a ways to do this one way or another. The guy running it is just beside himself because he can't get every help. And it's complicated when you go across state lines because the state of New Jersey, through the Port Authority, wants to get revenue to do projects over there, which I'm sympathetic with. But I understand that your problem, and hopefully you can find a ways out of it so that you stay in business.
All right, Mr. Mayor, our business is over for today. The clock keeps ticking away. Have yourself a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Looking forward to it.
All right, Mayor Michael Bloomberg.